7:08 in the morning, you're listening to Upfront. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert. Antonia Juhas is traveling in Europe this week, but I am joined because it is Monday morning and he has to be here anyway by Mitch Jezerich. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, sir.
I almost got your name out of my mouth.
Yeah, what were you about to say?
I don't know. I barely slept last night. Sunday nights are rough for me.
Yeah. Well, it was really windy last night, so maybe that had something to do with
it. My house was kind of rattling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. From the wind.
Yes. No, I assumed. Yes.
How was your weekend?
It was okay. I'm here.
You're here. I'm here. Things are happening in Washington. Let's talk about them. After all the Sturm und Drang over the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, a number of new Trump judicial appointments got ushered through onto the bench in pretty record time. What's going on?
So, on Thursday, the Democratic and Republican leadership in the Senate expedited and approved 15 of Donald Trump's nominees to the federal court, both the appeals court and also the district court. And that got some people quite angry after everything you saw with the Brett Kavanaugh fight, especially on the left. Progressive
By some people,
groups.
You mean everybody in my social media feeds?
About most people that you know.
Yeah.
We're upset at the Democrats for that, for agreeing to do it. And the reason the Democrats did it is so that they can get to recess quicker. I mean, a lot of this has to do with the midterm election that's now just 3 weeks away from tomorrow. And so Mitch McConnell made a deal. Because remember, previously he said there was going to be no break. They canceled the August break. And it's actually really in his advantage if you look at the electoral map for the Senate in November, where 34 Senate seats, something like 24 or 25 are currently held by Democrats. 10 of those are in states that Donald Trump won. So it would seem if senators were not on a break, not allowed to go home and campaign, it would end up favoring him just in the Republicans just by the numbers alone. So the Democrats really wanted this break. And one way they could get to this break was if they would have agreed to this deal with Mitch McConnell to pass these 15 Republican or Trump-appointed judicial nominees. Democrats, and Chuck Schumer says these were going to pass anyways. They were probably going to pass sometime in November, but his point was certainly before the end of the year. So yes, we expedited it, but we did it so we can get home and get to the election.
So a case study would be someone like Senator Ben Nelson, Democrat from Florida. He is facing a really stiff challenge from the state's Republican governor, Rick Scott, for his Senate seat. Scott has had himself up on the local TV news every night dealing with the aftermath of Hurricane Michael, right? He's kind of getting all this free media coverage, and Nelson hasn't even been able to like peel away to spend time setting foot in his own state during a time of crisis. And the latest polls have actually shown Nelson down a couple points.
Yeah. So that's that's the thing. Democrats are going to have a narrow opportunity to win the Senate in this midterm election, but they can't be really losing the seats they already have. In Florida, Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, she's pulling a little bit behind as well at this moment.
McCaskill in Missouri.
So, you know, I do think there's a political calculation. It didn't make people in your and my social media feed very happy. They want to see continued opposition to Trump's judicial appointments. And, you know, this comes as, you know, Mitch McConnell. Can I call him Mitch Machiavelli McConnell? He tweeted out after this deal made. Hopefully it won't be taken out in the archive. You know, he made this deal for these 15 additional judges. And now 1/6 of all federal judges, I think it is, are now Trump appointees. And in these past 2 years, more federal judges have been confirmed than in any time in history. Now, that shouldn't be too surprising, because the Democrats actually took away the filibuster to be able to use a filibuster for lower court nominees. And then obviously Mitch McConnell took it away for Supreme Court. But for the federal bench, that was already done by Harry Reid And so it shouldn't be surprising in these first 2 years you would see the most confirmation of judicial seats. And 1/6 sounds like a lot, but if you also put it in perspective, you know, you only have, what, 3 or 4 presidents in which current federal judges are actually serving because they were appointed by certain presidents. And I think also interesting to note is that Democratic-appointed judges still have the majority on the federal courts. Mm. If you look at the 13 district courts, Democrat-appointed judges are in the majority in 8 of the 13. 4 are majority Republican-appointed judges, and then there's 1 that's sort of evenly split at the moment.
Also, I think, you know, probably before George W. Bush, the party of the person who nominated you was not that determinative of your conduct as a judge. Not as much as it is now.
Yeah, except that there are plenty of people who would say that almost all the judges that Donald Trump has nominated are judges that people could very well see another Republican president nominating. Mm-hmm. And I even think that is true with what we saw in the Supreme Court with Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh as well. I mean, that's why I think the Republicans went to bat for him. You'll remember George Bush had some very controversial judicial nominees in, you know, 2003, 2004, and 2005. That's how the whole fight over the filibuster and the judicial nominees began. The whole talk about the nuclear option concerning the filibuster began during the George W. Bush years, right, because the Democrats were not allowing his nominees to go through. So back to Mitch Machiavelli McConnell, it's really fascinating to think about him because just a year ago, we were wondering on this very program, and I think other places as well, is he was going to survive as the majority leader, the Republican leader in the Senate. And he has basically slayed that opposition at this point. You don't hear that talk about Mitch McConnell anymore. And I think that has a lot to do with what has happened with these judicial picks and getting these judicial picks through, and especially getting people like Brett Kavanaugh through and Neil Gorsuch.
And also the giant, massive tax cut for the Republican donor class.
Yep. It was before that vote. You know, that was a very close vote, you'll remember. And it was just before that vote when there was a lot of questions as to whether or not it was going to get passed. That's when we started really hearing about the discontent towards Mitch McConnell within his own base. But that's dissipated. I don't hear that anywhere anymore.
Most importantly, you don't hear it from Donald Trump.
You don't hear it from Donald Trump just praised Mitch McConnell. Yeah. I mean, Mitch McConnell, this has been a year for him. He has fundamentally, I think, changed the way the Senate operates. Even if you got, I mean, he's a hero now. If you go to the conservatives, to the right, Mitch McConnell is now a hero. If you go back to his holding open the not allowing for a process for Merrick Garland, President Obama's pick for the Supreme Court. While people on the left do not look so fondly on Mitch McConnell for that, people on the right see him as a hero for all this, for what he has done. And to pretty much ensure, unless something happens, and something always could happen, that conservatives will control at least the Supreme Court for at least the next decade, you know, and again, unless something serious happens to one of the conservatives on the bench, and so yeah, Mitch McConnell's and I think this really gets at the question of how important this midterm election is, and especially for the Senate. Democrats can win the House of Representatives, and they can have all the hearings that they want, and they can have make some great spectacle. I'm sure we'll cover it, and we'll be interested in it.
And they'll have subpoena power.
But they'll have subpoena power too. Absolutely, they can get to Trump's tax records, which we know we all want to see now. We've always wanted to see, but after the latest reports concerning how he got his wealth, very interesting. But the one area where Republicans have had the most amount of success during the Trump period is with the federal courts and getting Trump's picks on the federal courts. And it still leans towards Democrats, if you look at it as Democratic presidents who have appointed federal judges. And that makes sense, because if you look before Donald Trump took office, that 24-year period, 16 of it was controlled by Democrats, right? Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, which is George W. Bush. So it makes sense that right now the Democrats would have Democrat-picked judges would have a majority on the bench. But at this rate, if they're able to keep up this rate of confirming people, even for the next 2 years, that could be pretty dramatic. They can really put a dent in the makeup of the federal courts, especially without a filibuster. Never mind 8 years. I think 8 years would obviously change it, maybe even flip it.
So separate from the 15 judges who've been confirmed lightning speed as part of the aforementioned deal between Senate Democrats and Mitch McConnell to get them on a recess so they can campaign for their seats, there have been a couple federal judges appointed in California bypassing something called the blue slip process, which apparently is a scandal. I have no idea what the blue slip process is. Can you explain it?
Well, the blue slip process is just basically a procedure and more of a way that more of a political norm than an actual rule or legal proceeding. And what it is when a president nominates a judge to a court. So let's say the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals here in San Francisco. The president would confer with both the senators and try to get both the senators, regardless of party, to agree on the pick, to kind of come up with a consensus pick in order to get that judge on the court. It was a long practice. That's not surprising that it has come to an end, as Donald Trump is not using that practice. He has appointed several people now to the federal courts in California without getting any input from Kamala Harris or Dianne Feinstein. And Dianne Feinstein's interesting because she's somebody on the Hill anyways, is very well respected, especially by Republicans. And so he has bypassed that. It makes sense this happens now that you don't have a filibuster anymore. Again, you don't, even if you're in the minority before with the filibuster, right, for judicial picks,
the rituals of getting buy-in kind of drop away.
So it just changes all the whole calculations on how these things work. Yeah.
Mitch Jeserich. So speaking of federal judges, there is a lawsuit over what is turning out to be a surprisingly close gubernatorial race in Georgia. Stacey Abrams is the Democratic nominee there. She'll be the first African-American woman to be governor in any state in the country. She has been polling literally dead even with her opponent, who happens to be the Secretary of State, Brian Kemp. One of Stacey Abrams' credentials to run for this nomination was that she had run an incredibly robust voter registration drive in Georgia. In 2014, that operation signed up 800,000 new voters. And mobilizing people who wouldn't typically go out to vote has been a big part of her campaign strategy. Brian Kemp is currently the Secretary of State, and that has put him in a position to take off of the rolls the voters that she has been signing up. AP broke the news last week. 53,000 new voters had been rejected under a system somewhat controversial. It's been litigated in Georgia before, called exact match, where if the paperwork you fill out to register deviates by so much as a hyphen, a space, or an accent from the way your name is recorded in other state records, you don't get registered. Somehow he managed to do that in a way that nearly 70% of those 53,000 people rejected are African American. What do we know about that lawsuit? Is this going to a Trump judge?
I don't know. I don't know about the... Do you know about the lawsuit?
I don't know.
Good.
I just thought you were studying up on the judiciary. Well, I was checking out the voter registration issue. I thought this would be where our two issue areas met.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. There was a lawsuit in 2016 because the same process happened. And Brian Kemp was also Secretary of State then. And through the lawsuit, and I don't know if it was ever, I don't think it actually ever came to a conclusion, but the lawsuit itself stopped that practice from happening of getting the exact match. Afterwards, Georgia's state legislature passed a law to try to ensure that this is the law, that getting this exact match is the law. And so now it has, you know, the signature of the legislature on it. So now Brian Kemp is coming at it and doing it again, and his office is doing it again.
Got it.
So that's what we have going on right here. If there is another lawsuit, it wouldn't shock me, right? Well, we just have to wait to see what a judge says.
Yeah.
That's usually how lawsuits work.
Interesting piece of goods that they have on him, perhaps showing a window into his thinking, is that in the closed-door Republican donor meeting several years ago, referencing that earlier voter registration drive, he basically said I am paraphrasing here because I don't have the exact words in front of me. If they keep signing up black people to vote, we're going to start losing elections.
Yeah. Yeah, they probably are. And you know, I look at that situation in Georgia. There are other situations concerning voting and the ability to vote that are kind of hot. There was the Supreme Court upheld a lower court decision concerning North Dakota and a voter ID law there that can adversely affect Native Americans.
Seems almost from voting. Certain to.
Yeah, and that is because in North Dakota, the law is that your voter ID law is that you have to have a residential address. And many people who live on a reservation do not have a residential address. Usually that's a P.O. box, is my understanding.
I believe that's U.S. Post Office policy with Native American reservations.
Yeah. And so let's just put this in perspective. We were talking about Heidi Heitkamp and her pulling behind a little bit right now, and she's the Democratic senator from North Dakota up for re-election. She only won her election in 2012 by 3,000 votes, and very much probably thanks to Native American voters. And so there are ways. I was reading the article about, okay, how can you, okay, so if you have a P.O. box, how can you get registered? You can do it. But as I was reading it, I realized it was so complicated. I wasn't really reading it. I was just kind of skimming, trying to get it over. So imagine if you were actually trying to vote and looking at something like that. So you look at North Dakota, you look at Georgia. There were a couple of interesting arrests of people who were trying to vote and also dealing and registering people trying to vote in Texas. And I look at this midterm election as I would be shocked if this is not we don't have the biggest turnout ever for a midterm election this year. In fact, I suspect it could rival presidential elections. And I would not surprise me if we end up seeing a situation of really long lines, a lot of issues come up over voting. And it also wouldn't surprise me if it becomes a real sort of focal point and hot point of what happens, say, the day after the midterm election or even the week after the midterm election, just the way that everything is now so hotly contested and challenged. I would keep my eyes on that. I think it's going to be an issue.
Well, as a matter of fact, we're going to tune in tomorrow. This time slot, folks, we're going to speak to the Brennan Center for Justice, specifically about vote purging practices, state by state, how they've changed since the Supreme Court weakened the prior review provision of the Voting Rights Act. Really kind of terrifying below-the-radar stuff that's been happening at the state level to just dramatically change who's even allowed to vote in the first place. Ms. Jeserich, before we let you go, want to talk taxes. The New York Times has been rolling out one story after another that never quite makes its way into the national spin cycle. When their first big story on the Trump family tax history came out, it was completely subsumed into the Brett Kavanaugh chaos. And their latest, which was on Jared Kushner, got pretty swallowed by the Kanye West White House summit.
Oh, but what a summit that was, Brian.
Long and the short of which is Jared Kushner managed to pay no federal income taxes over a period in which his personal wealth quintupled.
Yeah, between 2009 and 2016, the New York Times got some of Jared Kushner's records concerning, I think, a loan he was trying to get. And again, the weekend before, as you mentioned, when everybody was talking about Brett Kavanaugh, New York Times came out with a report about Donald Trump and what Donald Trump did, especially with his father when they were all younger, in getting his wealth, which may have been illegal. What Jared Kushner did probably is not illegal, but it does highlight what happens for developers and real estate. They are able to, the tax code is made so that if you own a building, they suspect appreciation to happen every year, that the value of that property is going to go down every year. And so that's how they put it in their taxes, when we well know that that doesn't happen to property. Property does not go down in value every year, especially right now. And so he was able to use that as in losses, but losses on paper only. He didn't actually lose any money. But because of those losses, which is, I think, totaled up to something like $8 million on paper, he basically didn't pay any income tax, federal income tax.
Yeah. And this is every landlord that owns rental property does this. It's a very common tax tactic. Interesting footnote on this. There is a little discussed provision in the tax bill that is going to amp this up on steroids. Something created, it's only been discussed that I've seen in one New York Times article that told kind of the origin story of how it came to be, that basically creates capital gains-free zones in the United States in poor neighborhoods, poor census tracts. How that's defined is kind of fuzzy, because downtown Berkeley, where you and I are sitting, is now an opportunity zone because it has a lot of students living in it and they show up as low income on census tracts. These are now places where someone can invest their money. They can take money out of a prior investment and get out of some of the capital gains they would have owned cashing it out. Invest it, say, building a shiny new tower, and as long as they keep it in that opportunity zone for 10 years, take it out without paying any capital gains on the appreciation. So you've potentially got a situation where someone like Jared Kushner could cash out a very lucrative investment, get out of the capital gains he would have had to pay, build a high rise in downtown Berkeley at a cost of $100 million, depreciate that over the course of 10 years, take $100 million off his taxes, and then pay absolutely no capital gains when he sells it to some private equity firm beforehand. That is pretty amazing if you are a wealthy land speculator.
And legal. Yeah. And keep that in mind when you look at all these cranes around town.